The words to which I should like to call your attention this morning are to be found in that chapter which we have read at the beginning, the fourth chapter in the first book of Samuel, reading the last two verses, verses 21 and 22. And she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory is departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory is departed from Israel, for the ark of God is taken." I want to take in connection with that also verses 33, 34, and 35 in the 40th chapter, the last chapter of the book of Exodus, where we read, "And he reared up the court round about the tabernacle and the altar, and set up the hanging of the court gate. So Moses finished the work. Then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation, because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." Now I call attention, I say, particularly to this history that is recorded for us in the fourth chapter of the first book of Samuel. And as we take it especially in the light of that other statement I've just read, which tells us of the first building and erecting of the tabernacle in which the children of Israel worshipped God, it seems to me that we shall find certain very vital and most important lessons for ourselves at this present time. The subject, in other words, quite plainly, is what we may call the essence of true religion. The essence of true religion. Now, why do I say that this is so important? Well, it's important for us as we are members of the church in general, and it's also most important for us in our own individual experiences. We are all aware of the state of the world. There is no need to waste time in reminding you of that. It's terrible. It's serious. It's appalling. We see it increasing and mounting day by day. But there is something which is much more serious than the state of the world, and that is the state of the church with such a gospel. Why is it that the Christian church is so ineffective with such a gospel? Why is it that so many of us individually are ineffective in our own particular circles, where we are able to exercise a certain amount of influence? Unfortunately, all who are at all serious about these matters must admit and agree that the position, the condition of the Christian church today, speaking generally, is one of deadness, of discouragement, and of failure. The enemy is, in these days of which we've been reading, the Philistines, the modern Philistines, are powerful and are successful, succeeding apparently all along the line. And the Christian church seems to be so powerless and utterly ineffective and almost effete. Now, the position, you see, is so different from what it was in the origin of the church, as you read about it in the book of the Acts of the Apostles. You've got this same contrast. Here it was in the Old Testament, the tabernacle being erected and filled with the glory of God. And then this later phase, "The glory is departed from Israel, for the ark of God is taken." And it seems to me that we are face to face with a similar kind of contrast. You think of the church at the beginning, and you think of the church in great periods of reformation and of revival, and you consider her and look upon her today. Or in the case of individuals, you read the experiences of people recorded here in the scriptures. You read about them in the biographies, the history of the church. And then we look at ourselves, and we see this appalling contrast, this difference Now, here is the thing I say that should be of great concern to all of us. And indeed, as I say, most people are prepared to grant that this, unfortunately, is the state of affairs and the true picture of the present position. And people are not only aware of this, they've done everything they can to deal with this situation. The church is busy. The church has been doing our utmost for many years and is still actively engaged in trying to restore the condition and to improve the position and the influence of the church. We've got all the varied activities with which we're all so familiar. Church union, multiplication of organizations, schemes put into operation, everything that men can do from the standpoint of organization and using his ability has been done. And yet, in spite of all the tremendous activity, the position deteriorates from year to year, and the church seems to become more and more dead and useless and almost irrelevant in this modern world, with all its tremendous problems, with all the tensions, with everything that is so true of the modern world. Now that, I think, you'll agree, is the position. And the question that we must ask ourselves is, why is this? What's the matter? Why is the church as she is? And why do all the efforts and the endeavors really lead ultimately to nothing? There are individual things that happen, and we thank God for them. I'm talking about the whole outlook, the whole condition of the Christian church. And as I say, the same thing applies also to individuals, individual Christians, in their own experience. Am I speaking to someone this morning who, looking back across his life or her life, finds this same extraordinary contrast? Is there someone who is using the words of William Cowper to himself or herself at this moment and saying, "Where is the blessedness I knew when first I sought and knew the Lord? Where is it?" Am I speaking to somebody? There are many such. This is common in Christian experience in the life of the individual. Well, now, if this is so, the question is, what is the matter? And I want to suggest to you this morning that the trouble at the time of Eli and his sons, the trouble today and at every similar period in the long history of the Christian church, is due to one thing only, and that is that we are guilty of neglecting the most important thing of all. And while we neglect that, of course, all our other efforts and endeavors of necessity can lead to nothing. Our trouble is, as it was with these children of Israel, I say, to ignore and miss the vital thing. What is that? Well, let me put it to you like this. The essence of true religion is the presence and the realization of the presence of the glory of God. That is the essence. That is the vital thing. The presence and the realization of the presence of the glory of God. The glory is departed from Israel. That's the explanation of the condition. And the contrast is, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Now here is the one thing that matters. Here is the most essential thing. The presence of the glory of God and our realization of that presence. In other words, what I'm trying to put to you is the difference between the practice of religion, as it is called, and true worship. Or if you like it in another form, it is an instance of the difference between religion and Christianity, or the Christian faith. Now, here I say, is the thing on which we should be concentrating. This is the thing that is so constantly emphasized in the Bible. The Bible is not so much a book of religion, it's a book which tells us about God. And it is God who dominates the whole of the Bible. There are contrasts in the condition of the people so frequently, and we get an account of them given us honestly in the historical portions. This is not a book that always describes the church as if she were perfect. No, we are given pictures such as this when we see the people of God down and defeated and disgraced. And it's always made perfectly clear that it is entirely due to one thing, and that is their relationship to God, the presence or the absence of the glory of God. Now, this was the thing, of course, that made the children of Israel unique. You remember the Apostle Paul in writing to the Romans, he says in the 9th chapter how he's concerned about the fact that the Jews, his fellow countrymen, were rejecting the gospel. This, he says, almost breaks his heart. He says, I could wish that myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh. Why? Well, he says, because they're Israelites, to whom pertaineth the adoption and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the service of God and so on. But you notice, he's put special emphasis upon the glory. He says the thing that has characterized you as a people has been the glory. Now, what is this? What is this which happened when the tabernacle was first erected? What is it when it says here the glory is departed from Israel? What is this peculiar and special thing? Well, it means, of course, the presence of God and the manifestation of something of the glory of God. Now, you remember that in the Old Testament and in connection with the tabernacle and the temple, this was something that was represented even in a physical and a material manner in the innermost part of the tabernacle. You remember the tabernacle was divided into sections. There were various courts. And there was one, and this was the special one, which was called the holiest of all. There was a holy place, but this is the holiest of all. And only one man was allowed to enter into that, and that was the high priest, and even he was only allowed to go in once a year. Why was this called the holiest of all? Well, that was the place in which, in particular, the representation of the presence of God amongst his people was to be found. It was there that they placed this Ark of the Covenant, which contained a golden pot with manna and Aaron's rod that had budded and the tables of the law. And there, over this box, as it were, this Ark of the Covenant, there were the cherubim, and then the glory of God upon it all. It was called the Shekinah. There was the presence of God was manifested in this almost physical manner there in the holiest of all. So that the children of Israel always associated the Ark of the Covenant with the presence and the glory of God. That is why this woman says, the glory is departed from Israel. Once the Philistines had captured the Ark, God, as it were, has gone. The glory of God has departed from Israel. So it means God's presence with his people. God's manifestation of his loving interest in his people, his concern about them, and his readiness to act on their behalf. That is why Paul puts it like that in Romans 9 and in the 4th verse, to whom pertaineth the glory. Not only the adoption, but the glory. He says, you know, you were a special people for one reason only, and that was that you were God's people. The adoption, yes, but God was with you, God's presence. You read all the history of the Old Testament. These were a small people, a small nation. Palestine was a small land, and yet these people were able to conquer great and mighty empires and dynasties. What was the explanation? Well, their teachers keep on telling them it was nothing in them. There's only one explanation, all the presence of God. And this is what the glory of God means, the glory of his power, the majesty of his power, this ever-living, almighty, all-powerful God, the glory of God was in the midst. And when that was there, none could stand against them. Now that is what this glory means. And obviously, therefore, it implies, you see, that we are in a living relationship to God. Something that is real to our consciousness. The Old Testament puts it in this more or less material form, but spiritually it is always true. The presence of God, the realization of the presence of God, an awareness of the glory of God. Now, the point I'm establishing is that this is the essence of true religion. And if this is absent, all the rest is useless. And, of course, what is amazing is that you can have so much without this. And that is where the devil leads us all astray. You can have many things without this and apart from this. But if this is not present, the rest will finally be shown to be useless and to be valueless. Now, I wish I'd had time to read to you that 40th chapter of the book of Exodus, because it's a most interesting chapter, which brings out this point to perfection and shows you what it really is that makes this thing vital and living. Now, in that 40th chapter, you read, "The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, On the first day of the first month thou shalt set up the tabernacle of the tent of the congregation." Then from that first verse to the 15th verse, you get a series of this. "And thou shalt put therein, and thou shalt bring the table, and thou shalt set the altar, and thou shalt set the altar of burnt offering, thou shalt set the laver." On it goes, a series of thou shalts. God is telling Moses what he's got to do. Detailed instructions as to how this tabernacle is to be set up in order that the people may worship God. And it goes on saying that until verse 15. "And thou shalt anoint them as thou didst anoint their father," and so on. Then at verse 16, and from verse 16 to halfway through verse 33, we are given an account of what Moses did. Verse 16 begins, "Thus did Moses, according to all that the Lord commanded him, so did he." And then you keep on reading this. "And Moses reared up the tabernacle, and Moses spread about the tent of the tabernacle, and he took, and he put, and he set, and he put, and he put, and he set." On it goes, until you come to the end of verse 33. So Moses finished the work. Everything has been done. The building is complete, all the furniture in position. Every veil, every tack, everything has been made according to the instructions, and everything is in position. So Moses finished the work. But you see, my dear friends, if we leave it at that, we are leaving out the most important thing of all. Verse 34. Then, after Moses has finished, after he's done everything, then, a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses can do nothing now. He's finished his work. Then God acts, and he covers the tent of the congregation with a cloud, and fills the tabernacle with his own glory. Now, the point I'm making, I say, is this, that it's that that matters. And it is that alone that ultimately matters. And yet we must always remember that these two things are vital, and the relationship between them is all important. Moses has his part to play, and he must do this. Then God. Now, the whole trouble with us, individually and collectively as members of the Christian church, is that we tend to forget one or the other of these two things, and hence all our troubles. Some people put their emphasis upon the first thing only, men's action, men's activity. Then others put the whole of their emphasis upon the second. They're not interested in what man is commanded to do and don't do it, but they wait. And nothing happens. The two things, I say, are all important and are absolutely essential. This is God's way. Now, what we must always realize, therefore, you see, is this. You can have so much, I say, without the vital thing. You can have buildings. You can have organizations without the glory. And the buildings may be excellent. And the organizations in the church, they may leave nothing to be desired. The motive and the object is good, and the arrangements are worked out in a most wonderful manner, and people are zealous. All may be there. But if you've only got that, you're lacking in the most important and vital thing of all. Let me say it from this pulpit. We can preach sermons, and we can preach good sermons. But if the glory isn't here, it's of no use. It may have some temporary passing purpose and function, but without the glory, the most perfect sermon, well thought out, balanced, arranged, perfect diction, everything, you can have it all. Not without the glory, the unction, the vital thing is not there. In other words, you see, you can have religion, you can be religious, you can be zealous, you can be active, without this vital thing. Moses had completed the work. It was all there. There's a religion. Everything's ready. Yes, but nothing happens until then, God. Let me go as far as this. You can be perfectly orthodox and hold the right views and have all your definitions complete and perfect, nothing left undone. But, my dear friend, your orthodoxy without the glory is useless and is valueless, and it will achieve no more than those who are heterodox in their doctrine and those who are merely concerned about activities and organizations. In other words, the great lesson that is taught here surely is this, that the two things are necessary, and we must never separate them, and we must never divide them. God gives his commandments, and we are to carry them out. There is Moses' part, yes, but without the then, and the cloud, and the glory, it all, I say, is useless and is valueless. I wonder whether I can put this point to you most clearly by putting it in the form of an illustration. I once heard an old preacher use it, and I thought it was a very good one. He described how, 60 or 70 years ago probably, electric tram cars had come to the town in which he ministered. And this is, he said, what he had observed. He'd seen men working for weeks and months. There they were digging up the road and putting down rails. Then after a while, they produced these tram cars. And they were all new, properly painted, everything perfect. And there they were, the rails and the tram cars on the rails and a pole on the top of the tram car. There was nothing happening, nothing moved. You could sit in the tram car, it wouldn't take you anywhere. It was all made absolutely perfectly according to the specification. And the rail was there. There was nothing lacking. And yet there was no movement. Why not? Well, the answer was, there was no power there. And the day of the opening came, and a member of the royal family came down, and all that he had to do was just to connect two little wires. And the moment the wire belonging to this machinery was joined to the wire that came from the powerhouse, everything began to move. Now there, it seems to me, is the position which is taught us so plainly here in the Scriptures. You can have all your arrangements, you can have everything perfect, all your definitions, your theology is right, your activities are right, your religion and your zeal are right, but unless the glory comes, if the glory is not present, it's Ichabod. It's an appalling thing, this, and God's people are so slow to realize this lesson. The essence is the glory of God, the presence of the glory, and our realization of it. So that brings me to my second principle, which is this one. The vital importance of our being sensitive to the presence of the glory, and that we should realize its all importance. Here again is something that comes out quite plainly in this particular incident. That is the astounding thing about this daughter-in-law of old Eli, the high priest. Phinehas' wife. You remember the story. Here were these people, the children of Israel, were fighting the Philistines. And the messenger comes back to give the report of the utter discomfiture of the army of Israel, and how the two sons of Eli had been killed, and how the ark of God had been captured by the Philistines. And amongst others, the news comes to this woman, the wife of Phinehas. She's on the verge of giving birth to her first child. Now, let's not forget this. To have a child was something which was considered of the most vital importance to women in Israel. You remember the many accounts which bring out this so clearly. It was almost a disgrace for a woman not to have a child. At last, this woman is to have a child. And the bringing of this news sets forth the process of labor. But this is what we are told. About the time of her death, the women that stood by her said unto her, "Fear not, for thou hast borne a son." They comforted her and they congratulated her and they cheered her. They said, "Look here, the thing that's important for you is that you're giving birth to a child. You've given birth to a son. It's wonderful. Your heart's desire has been granted." And they thought that she'd rejoice with them. But she answered not, neither did she regard it. And she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory is departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken," and she repeats it, "the glory is departed from Israel, for the ark of God is taken." Now, here is a woman, you see, who is sensitive to spiritual things. Even the birth of her son doesn't satisfy this woman. The tragedy, the glory of God is gone. The ark has been taken. What is the value of children or of anything else when this has gone to this woman? This was more important than life itself, more important than motherhood, more important than anything else. This was the thing for which she lived, the glory of God, and it's gone. The condition of Israel transcends everything in her own personal life and experience. And of course, as you read through your Bible, you find that this was the perpetual concern. You get it, of God's people, you find it particularly in the Psalms. Take, for instance, this 42nd Psalm. "As the heart panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God?" It's the living God he wants. He's got many things, but if he hasn't got the living God, he's unhappy. He's ill at ease. He's dissatisfied. Or take it again, as you get it perfectly stated in the 80th Psalm. "Hear ye, O shepherd of Israel, thou that leddest Joseph like a flock, thou that dwellest between the cherubims, shine forth before Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh, stir up thy strength and come and save us." You see, they'd got the temple, they'd got the tabernacle, they'd got everything, the appurtenances of religion, but the man isn't satisfied. "Turn us again, O God, and cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved. O Lord God of hosts, how long wilt thou be angry against the prayer of thy people?" Now, this is the expression of the same thing. Here are people, you see, who know what it is to experience the glory of God. "Return, we beseech thee, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven and behold and visit this thy vine. Turn us again, O Lord of hosts, cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved." And on it goes. "Surely his salvation is nigh unto them that fear him, that glory may dwell in the land." And I could read you endless quotations from the Psalms bringing out all this. "Lord, why castest thou off my soul? Why hidest thou my face from me?" Now here are people, you see, who know what it is to be rejoicing in the face of God. They know, they experience the presence of the glory of God, so that when it isn't there, they know, and they're unhappy and they long. Now here, I say, is the most important thing, that we should be like this wife of Phinehas, conscious of the vital importance of the glory and the presence, dissatisfied with everything else, mourning when we're not aware of the smile of God upon us and the realization of his nearness to us. Now, this woman, I say, and the psalmist, they were aware of this. They were sensitive to the glory and to the presence. but all are not. Was even Eli, the old man, the old high priest, was he sensitive? I think there is evidence that he wasn't. He was too indulgent as a father. He didn't do what he should have done. And it's quite clear that his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, they were not sensitive to the presence of God. You remember how they conducted themselves even in the tabernacle itself? No, these men, they were just practicing religion. They didn't know about the glory. They were not aware of the presence of the living God. And this is the tragedy of Israel. It's when that happens that Israel always goes wrong. And you remember the famous case of Samson, one of the judges of Israel, a remarkable man, and a man who was filled with the power of God and enabled to do wonderful things. But you remember how, as the result of his sin, he gave away his secret, and his hair was cut, and thereby his power was lost, but he didn't know it. And we read one of the most pathetic and tragic statements in the whole of the Bible. Suddenly Delilah says to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon thee." This had happened several times before. You remember they tied him down, but every time he got up and he could break through every band and bond and every kind of cord, he could take out nails out of the earth, he could carry doorposts with him, the gates of a city. There was nothing he couldn't do. He was so powerful. Suddenly Delilah says, "Samson, the Philistines are upon thee." And Samson got up and said, "I will go out as at other times before and shake myself." And he wist not that the Lord departed from him. And you remember how he was beaten by the Philistines and they put out his eyes and they make him a slave. Oh, here is the whole trouble. Hosea's got it. Strangers, he says, have devoured the strength of Israel, and he knoweth it not. Yea, grey hairs are here and there upon him, yet he knoweth it not. What a terrible thing it is when God's people have ceased to be sensitive to the presence of the glory, content with other things, and not aware that the vital thing has gone and has departed from them. What a contrast these people are, I say, not only to this woman and to the psalmist, but I've already quoted William Cowper. "Where is the blessedness I knew when first I sought the Lord? Where is it?" He was aware that he'd lost something. This is something that the saints have always emphasized. Brother Lawrence, practice of the presence of God. Practice of the presence, not merely saying your prayers. Many of his fellow monks were just content with doing their duties and saying their prayers. Not so, Brother Lawrence, the practice of the presence of God. George Muller used to tell people always that if they wanted to pray, the first thing they've got to do is to realize the presence of God, the glory. You can get on your knees and say your prayers, but my dear friend, that's nothing. Have you realized the glory? Is the glory there? Is the presence there? Oh, let me put it like this. This is what makes revival. That's what a revival is. A revival is the manifest presence of the glory of God. The glory of God suddenly coming amongst people. How is this to be known? How can we tell whether the glory of God is present or not? Surely that's the question many are asking at this moment. Well, you see, we are given the answer there at the end of that 40th chapter of the book of Exodus. "Then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because of the cloud and the glory of the Lord filling the tabernacle." That's it. Or take the case of Jacob at Bethel. Suddenly he becomes aware of the presence of God. This is the house of God. This is none other than the house of God. He hadn't realized it, he now does. This is none other than the house of God, the very gateway of heaven. What's it mean? Well, you see, this is it. The sense of awe, the sense of wonder, the sense of amazement, the sense of holiness and of purity, a sense of the majesty of God. This is the thing, I say, that makes us know that the glory of God is present. And that leads always to a sense of our unworthiness and a sense of our uncleanness. You remember Isaiah having just a glimpse of it? And he says, "Woe is unto me, for I am undone. I am a man of unclean lips." He was a very good man. He was a priest. He was a man who had always done his duty. But the glory. And he's undone. He's unclean. He's unworthy. He's humbled. He's filled with a sense of worship and of reverence and of adoration. He just waits in the presence of God. Now that is what is meant by being sensitive to the presence of the glory of God. This is the thing that makes true religion. You see, you can have everything else, but if you haven't got this, you'll miss the most vital thing of all. It is this awareness of the presence of God. It's difficult to put it into words, but you just realize it. You know that it's there, and you have a sense of utter dependence upon him, of confidence in his almighty power, and you wait upon him. Now, let me give you just one description of such an experience. It's an account given of a revival that broke out in a college in America 200 years ago, in the famous College of New Jersey, now called Princeton University. Here's an account of it, written by the younger William Tennant. He writes and gives an account to a friend. He said, "I went to college last Monday, having heard that God had begun a work of the Spirit there. And saw as astonishing a display of God's power and grace as I ever beheld or heard of in the conviction of sinners. Not one member of the house missed it in a greater or lesser degree. The whole house was a-bawling, all weeping. A sense of God's holiness was so impressed on the hearts of its inhabitants that there were only two who were esteemed to be religious whose hopes were not greatly shaken. The glorious ray reached the Latin school and much affected the master and a number of the scholars. I never saw any in that case who had more clear views of God, themselves, their duty, defects, their impotence and misery than they had in general." Now, there it is. There is a perfect description of it. You notice what he says. There was this sense of the presence of God. And he says that there were only two people who were known to him, who had always regarded themselves as Christians, who were not greatly shaken in their self-confidence, in their religion and their religiosity. You see, when you feel the presence of the glory of God, your religion becomes nothing. Filthy rags, useless. You thought you were all right, you were doing well. Suddenly you feel the presence of God, and you're unclean, and you're unworthy. You're filled with a sense of awe, and of reverence, and of majesty. God is a consuming fire, and you approach him with reverence and with godly fear. My dear friends, do you know the presence of the glory of God? I'm not asking you whether you're religious. I'm not asking you whether you're members of the Christian church. I'm not asking you how busy and occupied you are. I'm asking, do you know when the presence of the glory is there? Do you know what it is to feel that the glory has departed, that you've been left, and that you're alone? Here is the thing that matters. Here is a woman, I say, giving birth to her first child, a cause of great rejoicing, but she's sad. Why? Oh, the glory has departed. Ichabod. The glory has departed from Israel. Are you enjoying the presence of the living God? Is the church enjoying this today? Isn't this the tragedy? That this is not thought of. Everything else is being paid attention to. But the vital, the then, is entirely forgotten. Why is this? Well, there are many causes of this. And the most important thing for us to realize is that it is something that can happen gradually. It happens slowly, quietly, insidiously. And people often only awake up to the fact that it has happened, and there's some terrible defeat and disaster such as we are given an account of here before they realize that anything at all has taken place. It happens like the work of a moth or of rust, insidiously, quietly, slowly. Oh, the Holy Spirit is represented as a dove. He is so sensitive. He is the representative of the glory of God in this dispensation. But he's sensitive and he's delicate, and you can be loud and shouting and busy and active, and you're not aware that he's been grieved. He's gone. He's departed. What is the cause of this, I say? What is it that causes the glory of God to go? Well, the first obvious explanation is that it's due to our failure to keep ourselves in a sensitive condition. You've got to be sensitive to these things. And you've got to stop and to think and to examine. The great trouble of today is we are all so busy and all so active. Now, while I've said that Phineas's wife was able to realize that the glory had gone, I feel, you know, that even she was lacking in the true sensitivity in this matter. When she hears that the ark has actually been captured by the Philistines, she knows that the glory is gone. But you know, the glory of God had departed from Israel long before the Philistines captured that ark. That was only the end. That was the sort of crisis. It had been happening long before that, and she doesn't seem to have realized it before, but it had been taking place. Eli hadn't realized it as he should have done. The glory had gone long before this. It was because they had failed to keep themselves sensitive. Well, what is it that makes us behave in such a way? Well, the most obvious answer is the one that is given us here, as it is elsewhere in the Scriptures, and as you see it in the history of the church. It is that we are content with what we may describe as a mechanical religion. Look at these Israelites in this chapter. You remember the story? They went out to battle against the Philistines, and they were defeated. But then this is what I read. When the people were come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hands of the enemy." So the people went to Shiloh, that they might bring from thence the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth between the cherubims. And now they've got the ark with them in the midst of the battle. They say, "We're going to defeat the Philistines. We've got the ark with us." They said, "We were defeated before because in our folly we rushed to battle without taking the ark with us. Now then, we've got the ark this time." And they were shouting and full of jubilation. And indeed so much so that at first the Philistines were frightened. And they made a great appeal, "Be strong and quit yourselves like men, O ye Philistines, that ye be not servants unto the Hebrews as they have been to you. Quit yourselves like men and fight." But you remember what happened? Though they'd got the ark in the battle, Israel was not only defeated, she was completely routed, and the ark was captured. What was the trouble? Oh, you see their idea of religion? Mechanical. God in a box, as it were. Take the ark with you, you'll get success. Religion as a mascot. That's nothing but sheer superstition. And there are many people like that. The religion they have is nothing but a superstition. Oh yes, they say, "Believe in God. You never know when you'll be in trouble. And when you're very ill, it's good to be able to pray. When somebody dies, you pray to God." But that's sheer superstition. They don't think of him. They're not sensitive to his presence. They're not seeking his face. They're not crying out unto him as the psalmist does. No, no. Religion, take it up, put it down, use it as the Philistines take up the ark. Ah, this is very wonderful. Religion has something useful. But my dear friends, it's of no value. It's an insult to the living God. And it won't help you. Such a religion is useless. And isn't that the reason why the modern Philistines are so successful all along the line? Why is the church defeated? Why are we so ineffective? Why are we not thrilling with the divine power? The answer is, I say, we are resting on the organization. We are content with being religious. We are using the ark of God as a mascot, as some kind of something superstitious. It's useless. It's useless when you're facing the power of the devil and of hell. And you see, it leads to an emphasis on forms and ceremonies. People think that's the way to revive the church. You make the services more interesting. You vary them. Fresh translations. Translate your liturgy. Have more liturgy. Have processions. Deck up your priests. Do this. Do something spectacular. That's how they think they're going to defeat the Philistines. Using the Ark of God as a mascot. Materialistic religion. It's of no value. The Philistines always conquer such because it is the presence of the glory of God that alone can give the victory. And it's exactly the same as I was saying at the beginning with a dead orthodoxy. My dear friends, the fact that your orthodoxy is of no value unless you've got the living God in your orthodoxy, unless you've power, unless there's glory, unless there's spirit in it, it is useless. But thus, you see, we think we can fight the Philistines, and we are ignoring and forgetting the most important and the most vital thing of all. And then, of course, sin and disobedience. Like those two sons of Eli sinning in the very house of God. Like Samson, and like so many others throughout the ages and the centuries. There are the reasons why the glory departs, why God leaves his people, and why deadness falls down upon them. Very well, let me just ask a final question and give you some headings only by way of an answer. What are we to do about this? What of your own personal experience this morning? What is your spiritual condition? Are you alive? Are you rejoicing? Are you glorying in the living God? Do you know that he is with you? Is the Shekinah presence there? Are you sensitive and alive to the Spirit? And do you know that he's with you? If not, well then, my friend, I say repent. Realize the position and acknowledge it and confess it, not only to yourself but also to God. Realize that anything else is utterly useless. To know about God is not the vital thing. It is to know God and to realize him and to experience him. Repent. Then obey. Do all he tells you. Moses, take this, put that. You've got to. We'll never know revival until we obey God in doctrine. We've got to have the true doctrine based upon this book. God commands, as he commanded the details of the building of the tabernacle, he has told us exactly what we must believe. You'll never get any power in the church while she's uncertain of her beliefs. We must obey him in doctrine. We must also obey him in our living and in our daily lives and conduct and practice. You can do all else and it'll avail you nothing. This is God's way. And then, having done all, true in doctrine, clean and pure in life, realize that that alone is nothing. It's useless. Look up. Wait upon him. Pray to him. Plead with him. Express your longing to him. Where is the blessedness I knew? Return, O holy dove. Return, sweet messenger of rest. I hate the sin that made thee mourn and drove thee from my breast. Express your longing to him. Open your heart to him. Say, O Lord, how long? Have mercy. Seek his face. And as he is your Father in the Lord Jesus Christ, he will hear your humble cry, and the glory will come back. And you'll be filled with a sense of wonder and amazement. Indeed, you will be lost in wonder, love, and praise. Oh, my dear people, nothing matters but this, the glory of God. Filling the house, this house, the church, filling us one by one. Give yourselves no rest until you will know that the glory that has departed has come back. And God is again well pleased with you and ready to manifest himself to you more and more. Amen.